listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And with me today in the studio is America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio. It's great to have you with us, Pap. How you doing?
Good to be here.
It's great having you. Thank you. And you're going to be here with us for the hour, so we're going to kind of co-host the show here today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you. It's always fun. Always fun. So there's a lot of stuff that we can cover today, and a lot of stuff that I, over the 3 hours of the program, want to get into. From these five cranky billionaires who are messing with the world to what's going on with the minimum wage. Scott Walker's in trouble again. Actually, it's getting worse. I got some amazing news for you about the polar vortex. We'll be getting all that stuff as we go on through the show through the next couple of hours. Be careful of processed foods. But as an attorney, sir, you know the law. You know federal lawyers. You know federal judges.
It is my day job.
Yeah, there you go. My understanding is that President Obama has had some 90-some-odd federal openings?
96, yeah.
96 federal openings. And that even though they pulled the nuclear option, Harry Reid pulled the nuclear option on appointments, does that apply to judges or not?
I think it does. As a matter of fact, that was the whole purpose. If you remember, it all started in D.C. where they couldn't move anything in D.C. and they said, well, okay, well, then we're going to pull the nuclear option. I think when they knew that, I was talking about, that's just the beginning.
Right.
And that's bearing itself out. The filibuster was only one part of the problem. What you have in the Beltway, Tom, I call them the good old boy rules. And that is that it's not congressional mandate. It's nothing that is written in the law that says this is a statutory requirement. But what they've done is they've built all of these ways out for somebody. For example, Reid said, well, this is going to move things. And I think in his heart, he thought it might. But what has happened now is the Republicans are using all these other avenues of obstruction. One very clear avenue: don't show up to vote.
Really?
Yeah. Yes.
Deny a quorum.
Deny a quorum. You'll have 18 people that are show up, for example, the Judiciary Committee. Nobody shows up. No vote takes place. And unfortunately, there's been no attempt. If you think about a quorum rule in most settings,
let's first, not everybody doesn't know what the word quorum means.
Well, a majority. In other words, you got to have enough people there to count hands to vote. And if they fail to show up, they don't have that necessary majority.
Well, and it's legally in many circumstances, and I believe it's the case with these committees, you can't even hold the vote unless you have a quorum.
That's
you have to have a majority of the members present for the vote to have any legal standing. So,
but also, when you think about it, Tom, if you move outside the Beltway and you have a quorum requirement, and it's clear that it's bad faith, there's some avenue that you can take for that bad faith that does supersede that quorum limitation.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't done that. They need to. The second thing is you had Leahy that has, for some reason, allowed these senators to use this thing called a blue slip.
Mm-hmm.
And a blue slip is when a senator says, I really want this guy to be a senator, to be a judge. They have the right, the rest of the committee has the right to say, well, I'm not going to put my blue slip in and approve it. And therefore, if they don't do that, if they take no action at all, then nothing happens. Let me tell you the outside example of that. Marco Rubio, for example, down in Florida, he actually went as far as making a recommendation of a specific judge, Thomas Williams. And all of a sudden, now he's saying, yeah, I did make the recommendation, but I'm not going to let him move ahead. The story behind the story, Tom, is it's about voting. That's really what this is about. If you have appointments made in the judiciary and they're made by a Democratic president, then they're afraid that even though this may have been somebody I liked, that judge is more apt to support the Department of Justice or the presidential policy on things like voting. Now,
so you're talking about things like the Voting Rights Act,
exactly,
or things like
exactly.
voter suppression laws,
or any
that judges could overturn.
Yes, or any attempt to make voting easier in this country. There's no other explanation for it. The Marco Rubio story is just one of an example of about 19, and that is where even the state senator who says, yeah, this is my guy. He's a Democrat. I can go along with his politics. I'm going to go forward with him. But they're holding even those votes up. And it's very clear to me. I think it's not just me. It's not just my observation. I think other people are looking at this and saying, why? And it is because 2014, they have everything riding on it. And they don't want clear access to the polls. And they realize there's going to be federal judges. If they fill, for example, 32 judges right now, 32 judges out of the 96 have already been cleared. Some of them cleared unanimously in committee. Some of them have, you know, the absolute support of Republicans and Democrats.
These are judges who, if they've been appointed by a Republican president, by George Bush, would be judges right
for
now.
For sure. And you look at the history, and that's exactly what it bears out. So this is an important moment for the Republicans. They seem to be shameless about the idea that they're acting like children, because they have a plan and they do not want these federal vacancies filled. There's another part of it. I guess we can talk about later.
What's that?
Well, the other part is
if
you look at the appointments that have been made by Obama, they're not exactly thrilling. Hmm. If I were to analyze the appointments, I say. Where are even Obama's appointments coming from? They're coming from corporate silk stocking lawyers.
Right.
They're coming from places like Covington Burling. They're coming from Williams and Connolly, the Byrd law firm. These are people that make their living, their $2,000 an hour salaries for, you know, working on a case for a corporation.
Right.
They have no kinship with consumers. They certainly have no kinship with labor. They have no kinship. They might on social issues, but where it comes to really important issues, they're awful judges.
Now, the line that I had heard about that, or I've been hearing for 5 years here in this town, is that President Obama has been, or this administration has been, nominating judges who are more or less corporatists up to this point, because those were the only judges, but they were Democrat corporatists. Those were the only judges that they figured that the Republicans would allow through. And that now that Harry Reid has blown up the nuclear option, and that they might be able to get through any, you know, any person that they appoint. I mean, I don't know if there's a left-wing equivalent of Robert Bork out there or not, but he's going to start getting more progressive in his appointments.
It's not looking like that.
Okay.
I can tell you, it's not looking like that. A friend of mine, you know Howard Nations,
yeah,
a great lawyer from Texas, had the opportunity to meet with Obama about this. And he said, what is this about? Why are these corporatist lawyers moving in and taking positions in the federal judiciary that changes the rights of consumers? Why are you doing that? And I think the best I could make of it is his response was, you know, Michelle, my wife is a corporate lawyer. Do you really believe that she's going to favor one side or another simply because she was a corporate lawyer? Well, the quick answer is obvious. If what you do all day long is you're the servant to a corporation, you come into the business doing that, you make your living doing that, and then you get your appointment doing that, it's very unlikely that you can change in the midst of the stream and say, yeah, I understand the consumer's position. It's just all how we're brought up.
Mm.
And these people are brought up in silk stockings working for huge law firms that have no kinship with most of America, except maybe on social issues. Some of these Democratic choices by Obama have been good on social issues, but where it comes to money issues that feed your family, they have been awful. Not, some 80-90% of the decisions favor corporations in the Supreme Court.
Right. So once again, we get back to this issue of the federal judiciary. The fact that we now live in a constitutional monarchy.
Well, we do, don't we?
It's amazing. Okay, Mike Papatonio, attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio, is with us for the hour. And we will be taking your calls. We'll pop around a whole bunch of topics here. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, you can check out America's attorney, Mike Papatonio. You can check out his website at ringoffireradio.com. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Nate Sweet on the line with us. Hey, Nate.
Hey,
how you doing?
How's it going, Tom?
Nate is producer with The Big Picture. And let me get my TV show notes here. Hot. Ta-da. Okay. We're going to open up with a solo rant about judicial appointments.
Yes, we're going to be talking a little history lesson for all of our
Mr.
viewers.
Mr. Pickering! That's
about,
right.
Yeah, one of the craziest judges ever to step foot in an American courtroom. We'll be talking about him and using him as sort of a way to talk about some of the bigger issues you were just talking with Pap about judicial appointments and the power that federal judges have and why it's so crucial that President Obama win his battle with congressional Republicans, and more specifically Senate Republicans, about federal judicial appointments.
Yeah. So do you think Pickering had syphilis, or was he just an alcoholic?
I think he just liked to drink a lot.
Because they were talking about his morals a lot. You know, in any case.
I think in the 18th century, I guess 19th century at that point, they blended all those sort of things into one.
Yeah. Yeah. So Volkswagen is saying, Senator Corker lied. I mean, they're not actually saying that, but what they're saying is strongly implies that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because I think, as a lot of your viewers know, in the lead up or during the election process down in Chattanooga last week, Bob Corker said, Tennessee Republican senator, said that he had inside knowledge that if the workers voted against joining the United Auto Workers, that being the workers of the Chattanooga plant, the Volkswagen would award them with building a new SUV down in Chattanooga. But that statement has since been called into question by the head of the Chattanooga plant itself. And at the same time, now Volkswagen, the head of its works council in Germany, is saying that we need to, really question whether or not we want to expand our plants in the United States because we don't like the anti-union environment down there in the South. So it's kind of an interesting counterexample to what Bob.
Well, and the big picture behind it all is that Volkswagen is the way they say it in Deutschland is Volkswagen, is a German company, and they're required by the German Constitution to have half of the board of directors of a Volkswagen is made up of representatives of labor. And so, and that was the guy who spoke out to the Süddeutsche Zeitung, South German newspaper, daily newspaper. I used to read Süddeutsche Zeitung when we lived there. And it's kind of the Bavarian newspaper. And he basically said, if Americans don't want unions, if they don't want these works councils, if they don't want to do it the German way, then we'll consider building our factories in parts of America that do, not the South, or maybe in Canada or something like that.
So. Yeah, well, I think it also shows, the difficulty of the difficult conditions American labor organizers already exist under, because under federal labor law, in order to create a German Works Council in the United States, you need to vote to join a union, and then that union can work with the company to create a works council. So, there's that extra loop that we have to jump through in the United States that wouldn't exist.
So we're going to have Stuart Acuff on. And by the way, in our A and B blocks and our C block, our Your Take, My Take Live, Mike Papantonio is going to join me and co-host the show.
So. Yeah, it's going to be pretty exciting.
Yeah.
It's going to,
he's here right now. We're doing the radio show.
Yeah, viewers are going to get an extra special treat having Pap in the studio.
Yep.
Talking with Stuart. So some good stuff there in the first two segments.
In our D block, in the last block, we've got geeky science and Your Take, My Take.
Yeah, Geeky's talking about how plastic packaging and food goods could be threatening your health, and Daily Take is an examination of how American culture values black and white lives differently.
There you go. Nate Sweet, producer with The Big Picture. Thank you, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
See you in a few hours. 7 o'clock Eastern Time, The Big Picture. We'll be back. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman program. And, there's a lot in the news, but there is a lot on your mind, too. Your mind's collective. Mike Papantonio and I, America's lawyer, Mr. Papantonio. I call Bernie Sanders America's senator.
Well, he is, isn't he?
And I really think he is, and I think you're America's lawyer.
Well, thank you.
So, anyhow, Pap is with us, we'll both weigh in here. Marcia in Anger, North Carolina. Hey, Marcia. Red states and affordable health care, those two words don't usually find themselves in the same sentence.
Okay. So listen, Tom, I do want to tell you that, but I got to holler at my man, Pap. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I wanted to tell you something. I've been wanting to tell you the music in your show is awesome in the bumper, and if you could tell whoever runs your show to put the name of it someplace so I can look it up.
I will. Well, you know, we get a lot of compliments. But that's Scott Milliken and Farron Cousins do that, two of our producers. They're really good at choosing the right sound at the right time.
Oh, it's some of that stuff, like the Caribbean stuff. But anyway, I don't want to take up too much time on that. This is what happened. You may not know it, but, okay, so I live in a red state. I live in North Carolina. And when Affordable Care Act came out, I went online to apply. Of course, I had the same problems with the website. It wasn't working. And then I heard on somebody on one of the shows, you know, I listened to the Chicago Progressive all day long. So somebody called in and said, try einsurance.com. So I went on there, and I went through the process, and, okay, I make $9 an hour, so I was qualified for Medicaid. So, of course, the state doesn't take the Medicaid. So I thought, okay, well, I'm stuck here. But just the other day, I went back online to the Affordable Care Act. I called them up. And what I was going to do was bump my income up, just say I make $10 an hour, because I had played around with it on that e-insurance thing to see how much more money I would have to make before I would get a subsidy. So I was going to say, well, I'll just do that, because what my job offers is a limited thing, and I'm you know, curious how they're allowed to do that if the Affordable Care is in play. But they only offered a limited thing, so, like, I have to pay for my own labs and things like that, and it was going to be $21 a week. So I get online. I call the guy up, because it's better to do it over the phone and talk to somebody. And they process me through. And all he asked me about my income was whether I made more than $600 a month. And I said, well, I do make more than that. So I got a subsidy. And so I wanted to share the news that if you're in that gap, you think you're in that gap, just call up and apply, because you get the subsidy, you can use it. I'm getting health care for $15 a month.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you've got to, at the end of the year, though, you have to make sure that you actually made what you said you made, right?
Well, that's true, but if it's just a little bit more than what I really do make, I mean, we could scrounge it up. I have my tax return now. I can pay the subsidy for the whole year.
Cool. Be very careful. Well, we cannot advise anybody to operate outside the...
It sounds like she may be right within the bounds.
Yeah. Marcia, actually, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing that. Yeah, that is an important thing. Or it may be that if you're in the position where, if you're in that red state donut hole, and you're, say, $1,000 a year short of making it, it might be worth getting a part-time job over the course of a year, you know, just working Saturdays or something covers that $1,000.
Well, she did the right thing by putting it in their ball. The ball was in their court. They said, do you make this? And she answered, I think she's going to be fine. And
It's going to be interesting to see how the enforcement mechanism works on this, because it's going to, you know, at the end of the year and on top of that.
Pretty ill-defined right now.
It is. It's all pretty sloppy. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
All right, how you guys doing? You have the man Mike on. I love you, Tom, for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyway, what I wanted to say was, I'm trying to figure out how we can stop this snowball coming down the hill and getting bigger and bigger. What I mean is, the Democrats are incrementally moving to the right. For instance, when Senator Murray came out of the room with Congressman Ryan, I mean, the Republicans, they had to be cracking the champagne bottles and laughing and living it up after that deal that she made. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. The Democrats are constantly moving further and further to the right. And, like, for instance, the next presidential election, you know, everybody's getting their money from the corporations and Wall Street, so that's who they're going to serve. So, you know, how can we convince Americans that we need campaign finance reform? Because if we don't get campaign finance reform, nothing's really going to change as far as us progressing as a nation. So I would like your observations on that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Wayne, for the call. Personally, I would say that, you know, movetoamend.org has got this thing nailed. We need an explicit, clear, simple, you know, just a few sentence amendment to the Constitution that says that money is not protected by the First Amendment and corporations are not protected by the 14th Amendment, period. And then, you know, I mean, I know Republican politicians in this town as well as Democrats. I don't know any Republicans as friends, but I, you know, you talk to them. And I, here in this office building, there's a whole bunch of offices that they rent because we're just two blocks away from the Senate buildings, where you see, you'll run into senators in the hallway all the time. And they're coming here to do dialing for dollars. And they, the Republicans hate it as much as the Democrats that they got to spend 6 hours a day dialing for dollars. Your thoughts?
Well, the heart of it is corporations as a person. I'd be interested to know there will be somebody that will creatively come up with an with a lawsuit, and it'll be this. If they are purely a person, if a corporation is a person, let's draw some analogy. Let's say, why are they handled differently on immigration? Why must an immigrant, for example, come from Mexico and plant and jump through these hoops to become a citizen of this country when a German corporation or Asian corporation can come here, set up shop almost overnight? Somebody's going to test that, and we're going to find out, are they really a person?
Yeah, well, that'll be an interesting test. Well, that'll be a very
a lot of ways they can do that.
Right? Indeed. We'll be right back. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Mike Papantonio with us for the hour. America's lawyer. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with your calls for me and Pap, and you can check out his website at ringoffireradio.com. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you 28 minutes before the hour. And America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, on the line. Not on the line with us. In the studio. Live and in person. It doesn't get better than that. It doesn't get better than that. Mike in Parker, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom and Mike. Thank you both for all that you've done for Progressive America. I have a legal question for America's lawyer.
Okay, go for it.
Does the President of the United States have the authority to issue a presidential executive order to the director of the IRS directing him or her to interpret the law on social welfare organizations, Section 501(c)(4), to say that organizations must be involved exclusively in social welfare instead of primarily?
Yeah, that usually takes place by what they call a writ of mandamus, and it'll typically come from the executive office. It won't be the president doing an executive order, but it'll need some judicial oversight, and it's usually called a writ of mandamus. Sometimes it's characterized as a writ of prohibition. They may be doing something that they're not supposed to do, but what he tries to do is he tries to put that within a definition that requires a judge to make some type of ruling, and therefore he has some type of leadership in that regard. But it always it happens with what they call an extraordinary writ, not an executive order.
But the president could do it.
Could do it. Yeah, the administration can do that by way of the attorney general.
And they're basically behind in these super PAC wars. I mean, I don't know why
way
he doesn't
behind.
Do it.
It's, way
it just,
behind.
It just makes perfect sense. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, you're on the air with Pap and me. What's up?
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to talk about the German economy, which is actually doing quite well and has been able to weather in the Eurozone the crisis that has hit other countries much better, and it's because they are one of the biggest exporters of manufacturing goods or manufacturing.
Second largest in the world.
Right. And, well, I heard the second after China. But anyway, I just wanted to say that the reason that they've been able to do this is because they've really invested in their population, particularly in science and engineering, and they have supported people all along since World War II to continue to make Germany one of the strongest countries in that area. And instead of financializing their economy, they have supported that.
They've industrialized it. Yeah.
And I think in the long run, you know, this is the answer. I mean, we used to have in the Midwest here, I'm in Minneapolis, you know, some these cities were all manufacturing, very strong, and made high quality products, and there's no reason why we can't continue to do that, but you have to really invest in people. And I remember in the 80s speaking to a German who went studied at Los Alamos Labs when I lived in New Mexico, and you could actually get three quarters of your previous salary to study something, if you had a real plan and they believed in what you were doing, they would pay you to go to school and on top of the tuition, they would give you a lot of support. And this is how they've been able to go from steel and these kinds of industries to these very high-tech industries, and they take a lot of pride in what they do. And I knew somebody once from H.B. Fuller who was complaining about how they over-engineer everything. He was a chemical engineer, and I thought, can you ever make a product that is, you know, too good? I mean,
right.
Really.
Right, yeah.
Anyway,
excellent point, John. Thank you for the calling and making it. Pat, there's a couple of pieces to that in my mind. One is our trade policy. Alexander Hamilton proposed his 11-point plan for trade back in 1791. Washington adopted all of it by 1793. And we had an average 32% tariff on imported goods in the United States from 1793 until the 1970s, until Nixon started cracking it, and really, arguably, until the 1980s. And now it's less than 2%. So if you made, and the theory was, if it costs a buck to make a pair of shoes in labor, to make a pair of shoes in North Carolina, and you can do it for 50 cents of labor in Mexico or 10 cents of labor in China, then there's a 50 cent tax at the border on a Mexican import and a 90 cent tax on a Chinese import. We did away with that with these free trade agreements. But the way that Germany got around this, because Germany has also dropped their tariffs, is they use a value-added tax, a VAT tax. And so at every stage along the manufacturing route, when you make iron ore into iron, they pay a small tax. When you make iron into rolled steel, you pay a small tax. You make rolled steel into a car door, you pay a small tax. You put the car door on the car, you pay a small tax. And you add it all up, and the value-added tax on a German automobile is around 18%. And so that's a tax that only Germans are supposed to pay. So what they do is when they export that automobile, they reverse out that VAT tax. So they're exporting with an 18% discount. If, on the other hand, you want to take an American-made car and import it into Germany, they say, well, you never paid VAT tax on those things. So you're going to have to pay 18% VAT tax at the border. So on the import, there's an 18%. So the differential is the equivalent of 18 plus 18, which is what, 36? 8 and 8, 60. Yeah, 36. It's equivalent to a 36% tariff. And that's how Germany is, and Japan does this, China does this, Taiwan does this, South Korea does this. Why don't we get smart about trade policy here in the United States? I don't get it.
Well, I think trade policy is part of it, but I also think he started his question to me, what I heard.
Yeah.
They build the engine for people to become productive in their society.
Yes.
They build an infrastructure for that. They have, as you know, by the time somebody reaches junior high school, they say, you know, that person may say, I really want to build cars. Mm-hmm. Okay, and he's saying, well, that means I really don't want to go to university and study anything except what helps me build cars. I want to be a stonemason. I want to be an electrician, whatever it may be. They invest into the trades just as much as they do in to any degree in Germany.
Yeah.
He was talking about you can be paid to go to school. That is true. If you say at an early age, gee, you know, I'd like to be a welder. I'd like to be such a specialist in welding that I know every type of welding. I become a true specialist. Well, they'll say, okay, that's fine. We'll help you go to school and we'll pay you to do that. And I think what they've done as far as quality, that they've improved their quality, first of all, but they've actually made everybody more productive.
Well, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we did that here. My dad worked in a tool and die shop.
That's what I was going
to
say.
And one of my brothers wanted to become a tool and die maker, and he went through the first year of the journeyman thing, and it was so rigorous.
Right.
And he had another opportunity.
Is that still the case, though?
No.
No, I don't think so.
Not to the best of my knowledge. I mean, the tool and die, the union that represented him is still around, but I don't think they have even a shadow of it. Power and training that they used to have.
But when the government says it's important and we have to build an engine of productivity that everybody can be, you can make a great living in tool and die, or you can choose to make a great living as an attorney, but you can make a great living.
That's right.
And you can live with some caliber of decency.
And become part of the middle class. I mean, average manufacturing salaries in Germany are in the high 40s, low $50
per
hour.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it's just nuts. I mean, they don't even have a minimum wage in Germany because it's like, who would pay somebody $7.25 an hour? It's unimaginable.
Yeah, before you get to the border of shipping things out of the country, first of all, you have to have the ability to do those things.
Yeah, yeah. Plus, free education. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael. You have a question for Mr. Papantonio?
Yeah, hey, Mr. Hartman and Mr. Papantonio. Pap, I'd like to ask you as a lawyer a question. I asked Senator Sanders, has the statute of limitations run out on the banksters for prosecution now that we're 6 to 7 years out? Have they got away with that? Thank you, sir.
Well, there's a very, yeah, okay, first of all, the question becomes, has there been continuing conduct to cover it up? That's how I always move statute of limitations. If I have a corporation that committed a specific act and I think I've got 5 years or 6 years to do something, what I'll do is I'll look at the case and I'll say, let me see what their continuing conduct was before that point in time. What did they do to hide it? What did they do to cover it up? What did they do to actually continue to break the law in reporting or failing to report? And so it's a moving target. And I've always, to this day, I believe the statute is still viable, but you have an attorney general that does not have courage. This attorney general, he comes out a couple of weeks ago talking about issues that are great on social issues, but where it comes to issues about changing the culture of this country and how we do business between the 1% and the 90%, do we allow the 1% to steal from us and then make them pay a fine when they get caught? And on the other end of that, the person on a street corner selling a baggie of marijuana goes to prison. If he's done it three times, he goes to prison for life. So we have an attorney general that is without courage. He simply does not have the courage or the wherewithal to do this. It's easy to understand when you understand where he came from. He came from Covington Burling, which is a firm right here in Washington, D.C. They are completely, utterly immersed in corporate law. This is all this guy's ever known, is defending corporations and defending the criminals, the white-collar criminals in those corporations who make horrible decisions. So, yes, the answer is statute of limitations probably has not run. Second part of it, we have a Department of Justice at the leadership of Eric Holder that will do nothing about that.
And Eric Holder answers to the president, and so that takes you to the White House comment line and call your two senators and your member of the House of Representatives and put all the political pressure you can. I mean, Ronald Reagan prosecuted 1,000 banksters, and that was just for the SNL
crash. Yes, and it changed culture on SNL.
It sure did. Well, he also nationalized
exactly.
them. I mean, every single stockholder got totally screwed.
Exactly.
And put Bill Seidman in there, and 22 years later, they had unwound the whole thing, and the government showed a profit on it.
Yes.
They could have done it. Anyway, the template was there. George Bush could have done it in 2008, but he chose not to. And Obama arguably could have done it in 2008. We'll be back with Mike Papantonio right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Pat's website at RingOfFireRadio.com. 15 minutes before you. Welcome back. Joe, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network in Coldersport, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Hey, Joe, you used to work for Volkswagen?
Yes, I did. I'm retired now.
Mm-hmm.
Great, great company to work for. I spent a lot of time in Germany with Germans. I was in several of their plants in Germany. The last time I was there in 1987, they had the largest automobile complex in the world at Wolfsburg. They had 64,000 people under one roof. And I can tell you this. This is something, I don't know if you have this information. All of the hourly rated people, labor in Germany at all of the Volkswagen plants, they belong to, I think it's the largest union in the world, IG Mattel.
Mm-hmm.
And they cover all of Europe. But all of management in Volkswagen belongs to a union also.
That's right.
Right up the chain. They all belong. In fact, any place in Germany where they have labor and management, labor and management both belong to unions. Not the same unions, but they belong to unions. They're represented by unions. And another thing I wanted to mention to you, I hear you know, you talk a lot about the Reagan tax breaks. I'm not a right winger, but out of the whole administration, one guy that I had any use for the Bush administration was Paul O'Neill. He seemed like a pretty straight up and down guy, and he wrote a book, and he had a conversation with Dick Cheney. And this is when, you know, they were booming. They were into power. They had control of everything. And that's when they put these tax breaks for the rich into law. And Paul O'Neill told Dick Cheney, he said, "You'll bankrupt the nation." And you know what Cheney told him?
Reagan taught us that the deficits don't matter.
Deficits don't mean nothing. They don't mean nothing. And that's the kind of people that ran this whole train right into.
Well, you know, the reality is when a Republican is in the White House, deficits don't matter. As soon as a Democrat comes into the White House, the Republicans all start screaming and yelling about deficits so that the Democrats have to shoot Social Security, you know, shoot Santa Claus. I mean, we've talked about that. That was Jude Wininsky's, you know, in 76. He said to Republicans, you know, here's this two Santa Claus strategy. You know, the Democrats have always been Santa Claus. Republicans have always been Scrooge. But anyhow, your thoughts on this, Mr. Papantonio? We have a minute to the break.
Well, one thing that I when you started talking about Reagan and tax cuts, I don't know if you followed this. Stockman came out years later and said what a terrible decision it was.
Yeah, David Stockman apologized.
What a failure trickle down was. Yeah. When you have the guy who helped engineer it apologetic, saying, gee, I made a terrible mistake. We made a terrible calculation. He said that probably within 7 years of Reagan's administration. Nevertheless, the brain-dead GOP still embraces it, still hear it today. Give billionaires more money, everybody's going to do better. Stockman himself said, it was a miserable failure. I have to admit it because I helped write it.
Right.
I don't know how more compelling you can get.
Yeah, and he was the head of the Office of Management and Budget.
Yes,
and
that's
in fact,
right.
He's been on this program. We've talked with him.
Okay.
He got basically...
Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did. And it was like David Frum. I mean, you know, as soon as he started telling the truth, you know, or Paul Allen Roberts, or forgetting his name, but a number of these Reagan officials and you know, or former, you know, people who were in tight with the Republican Party in the 80s, and then in the 90s and 2000s, they start telling the truth, and boom, they're out. They're standing on the outside looking in. No more George Will treatment for them. 10 minutes before the hour, Mike Papantonio with us. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, and I am co-occupying it today with America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio. So glad to have you with us, Pap. And Mel in Chicago, listening on WCPT, you are on the air with Senator... I'm so wired to say with Senator Sanders from doing those Fridays for 9.5 years. I can't elevate you to Senator yet.
I could never stand in those shoes, trust me.
With Mike Papantonio. You wanted to talk about Mr. Corker?
Did I hear right? Did you say Mel?
Yes, Mel, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, I missed the joke on calling Pap a senator, and then I was laughing. I couldn't hear what you were saying.
Okay.
Pap, I love your work. Tom, I love your work, and either one of you guys can be senator. I'll move and I'll vote.
Thank you. But
I want to make a point, Tom and Pap. We forget that many landmark cases like Citizens United, not that you forget, came from personal lawsuits. And I'm thinking Corker, with that stunt he pulled, that dirty stunt, derailing the auto workers' vote in Tennessee, somebody could bring legal action as far as breaking his oath of office. Look at Republican governors. They are blocking Medicaid expansion. They are misleading their constituents on how to sign up for Obamacare. They're launching bogus websites to confuse people. I'm just wondering, number one, why can't lawsuits begin to be generated that would rein some of these things in? Because everybody knows, you say it all the time, you let a crook go, and guess what? He keeps going. And I would just like to say, with this 2014 election year, everyone – please follow and to contribute and support the Brad Blog with my good friend Brad Friedman. He's doing fabulous work on election fraud. So stay with Brad Friedman as we get closer to November. I'll give it back to you.
I'm with you, Mel. Brad's a good friend and a good guy. So Pap, Shano and I have talked about it. Shane is a law school graduate, and he's a Supreme Court reporter for Talk Radio News. And isn't there an issue of sovereign immunity here, or some sort of immunity that
you
that
mean
senators,
the senator? Oh, of course, you know, there is. Yeah.
So you could not initiate a lawsuit against Bob Corker. But the president could. But then you'd have a constitutional crisis, wouldn't you? That would throw up to the Supreme Court.
to get where you want to go, you would have to do it outside of conduct that this elected officer has been involved with. And, right. And now's not the time for that. You see, you want your test cases to come up during a time when you have a court that might make good law.
Right.
Because here my fear is this court has made such terrible, terrible law. And in the old days, that was a big problem because they created a precedent. There was the notion of stare decisis, as we've talked about, and here's the law. And my fear is that if we ever do turn this court around, that they won't have the same kind of courage to be, look, this is what we are. We are activists. Mm. We're activists in the sense we have to turn around this horrible stuff that's happened. So if you initiate lawsuits right now on behalf of social change, you're going to do it facing Scalia, Roberts, Thomas, Alito. It's going to be a disaster. Kennedy. And so now's not the time to try to make.
But if you had a decent court, would it even be possible to use the law to go after Senator Corker?
No, it wouldn't. I don't know how you would get there. And it would have to be conduct. There's conduct that becomes what you call ultra virus. It becomes some conduct that's either reckless, indifferent, intentional, that sometimes you can get around the immunity law.
Right.
But let me just tell you, these immunity laws are written so strong. I mean,
Well, they're written by the people who are immunizing themselves.
Well, that's right. Let me immunize myself from the bad things
right.
that I'm going to do.
Right.
That's
essentially what they did. Amazing. David in Portland, Oregon. Hey, David. Thanks for listening or watching over at TomHartmann.com. You're on the air with Mike Papantonio and me.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hello? Okay, I'm sorry. Over the past few years, I've been getting more and more sickened by what I hear in the media. And some stations, like I can't listen to National Petroleum Radio anymore because it's any more than 10 seconds before I hear something that's just really offensive to me. And I'm hearing things now from, I will mention no names, but I'm hearing people advocating for certain issues. Take the Keystone XL pipeline, for instance. I'm hearing people advocating for this that I would never believe in a million years would go for that. And I would like both of your opinions on what you think the consequences of this Keystone XL pipeline are. And if there's any hope of turning things around in this media, it just seems like it's shifting more and more to the right, being bought by the rich. And if you could reflect on that, both of you, I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you, David. Well, it's easy for me. I own this show. Mm. Louise and I own this show. Mm. Not everybody owns their own show, but I don't know. What are your thoughts on the media?
Well, I mean, look, the arguments that you hear, the very fact that the argument is being made is taking us away. I mean, specifically about the pipeline.
Mm.
We spend time to go, do we need this pipeline? How do we do it? Where does it go? The real issue, and those arguments take us away from the bigger picture, which is, shouldn't we be concerned about the picture of fossil fuel? Shouldn't we be concerned about promoting arguments that, again, have us focused? You see, now, don't get me wrong. My position on XL Pipeline is we shouldn't have it. But the point is, I almost equate it to watching Honey Boo Boo, okay? Mm-hmm. We watch Honey Boo Boo, and we don't think about what's going on in the real world. Honey Boo Boo, we want to watch how ridiculous can this be, how inane can this entertainment be. What ends up happening with an issue like this, it's a subpart of the macro issue. The big issue is, let's start talking about how we lay in geothermal and solar and wind energy in a bigger way.
How we deal with the biggest threat to the human species has faced.
This is only a small part of it.
165,000 years on the planet. America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com. Check it out. Pap, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Great having you with us. We'll be back. I'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann.
Hey friends, Tom Hartmann here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartmann program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site. and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back, Tom Hartmann and John Nichols, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, thenation.com, on the line with us. Hey, John.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Tom.
Great to be with you, too. You live in Madison, Wisconsin.
And
you would think, watching the media these days, that the only Republican scandal going on in the country is New Jersey and has to do with a bridge, but... Scott Walker, your governor, seems to be having a few problems. Can you tell us what's going on out there?
Sure, Tom. What if I said to you that there's a Republican governor involved in a front page of the newspaper lead of the evening news scandal that involves the very revealing emails of top aides, charges that he put friends and political allies into positions for which they were not qualified, and a host of revelations about secret politicization of his office and, you know, ill use of his public position. You would probably say we were talking about Chris Christie.
I think most people would, yeah.
But every one of those things is happening today in Wisconsin, statewide. All of the media, front page of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a newspaper that endorsed Scott Walker for governor and opposed his recall. Top of the fold, across the front page stories about the governor knowing about, being involved with, a secret system of using his political appointees, people who are serving on the public payroll, to do campaign work, which is completely illegal, as well as just an immense amount of additional information. 27,000 pages of emails have come out as part of a legal proceeding, as well as 400 legal documents. And what these show is that Scott Walker was, at the very least, aware of, and by most indications, highly engaged with, a politicization of his office that in many ways parallels exactly the kinds of things that people have had concerns with regarding not just Chris Christie, but Tom Corbett in Pennsylvania, Governor LePage in Maine, and several others.
Or Richard Nixon.
Sure. There's a lot more documentation.
I mean, at its core, this is what Nixon did.
Yeah. And, you know, it's very interesting because you would go there, Tom. You know the history, and you know about, you know, secret taping systems and things of this. But this is interesting because what is revealed here, which, you know, elements of which we knew about before. But what's revealed here is that when Scott Walker served as Milwaukee County Executive, the position from which he ran for the governorship, his aides set up a secret routing system within the office so that his public employees could sit at their desks and use laptops that were run through this secret router system and thus could communicate directly with the campaign and do campaign work. And literally, one of these aides sent by, if we're right on that, people are still counting them, roughly 3,000 fundraising emails while at work.
Whoa. Two real quick questions on this, and I'm expecting you can expand considerably on these questions. But number one, is a federal prosecutor involved yet, or will there be one? And perhaps more importantly, number two, or maybe not more importantly, but number two, if Scott Walker can succeed in keeping this a local issue, in other words, everybody in the state of Wisconsin knows he's corrupt, but nobody else in the country knows, You know, conventional wisdom right now, at least here in Washington, D.C., from the Republicans that I've talked with, is, and I've had several of them come on my program to debate me on various issues, and I say, who are you going to run? You know, Chris Christie's down the tubes, and they go, Scott Walker, of course. Conventional wisdom is Scott Walker is the guy that, the you know, he's the great savior that the Republicans are going to turn to in 2016. Is it possible that he could still do that and just not carry his own state?
Well, in fact, as you well know, no Democrat candidate for president has lost Wisconsin since 1984. So,
but you don't have a lot of electoral votes there.
No, not a lot. But if you're talking about that, carry his own state, yeah, the polling suggests people aren't particularly enthused by the idea of a Walker presidential run, although he still polls reasonably well in a very divided state as the governor. But here's the interesting thing about this story. Some of it people know. Remember, he was the subject of a John Doe investigation, which is a form of investigation where a county prosecutor sets up a tribunal that looks into a host of issues related to presumed crimes. Mm-hmm. Out of that initial John Doe investigation, six of Scott Walker's aides were charged with crimes. One's in jail right now. Another faces jail time. Several others have been convicted. And so you have things that have already happened. This did not go to a federal prosecutor. It continues to be run through state and local prosecutors. What we know from press reports is that there's a second John Doe inquiry that is now in play, and that takes many of the issues raised by these emails, which relate, you know, again to the first one, and updates them, and some of the same players coming into an investigation of the period after Scott Walker became governor. And so there are inquiries going on, and that gets to the heart of your question, Tom. You're asking, can this guy go national? Can he be their presidential candidate? I can tell you right now that there are a lot of Democrats who would love it, who actually probably would contribute to get him as the candidate, because this
I mean, that's what, you know, John, I think you're old enough to remember what Democrats were saying about Ronald Reagan in early 1980.
Different game. They said that about Reagan because they didn't respect him as a communicator. They didn't respect him as an individual. I'm saying this because this guy is carrying baggage that is very, very heavy. It's not the same baggage as Chris Christie, but it is a guarantee of future revelations.
Right.
You know, as this whole thing was playing in Wisconsin today with these 27,000 pages of emails and 400 legal documents coming out yesterday, there was a study that came out detailing the politicization of his economic development efforts, where literally money going to the legislative districts of political allies at an incredibly, an undefendable pattern. And it's with an agency that has had a number of other scandals and controversies.
In other words, he's using state and federal money to punish his opponents and reward his allies.
Does that sound a little like Sandy funds?
Yeah. Well, and again, it sounds like Richard Nixon.
I come to here, though, Tom, is this core thing. You can like Scott Walker or dislike him. You can approve or disapprove of him politically. I am telling you that just as Chris Christie has been, I think, written out of the 2016 presidential race, not merely because of what's happened, but because of an assumption of what will continue to come out in the weeks and months to come, Scott Walker has similar problems.
So, John, there are some who would argue, and I think you might be one of them, that Scott Walker is more the creation of the Koch brothers than anything else, that without their money, he would not be governor, or at least a lot of the things that he's done would never have happened. What does this mean for the Koch brothers in the minute we have left?
Well, it's a serious problem because, you remember, Chris Christie was also something of Koch brothers' creation, a guy who they invited to their national events and celebrated at a very high level, so we're certainly very excited about. And so they keep trying to spin people up from outside Washington who are very reliant on them. Remember, if you're at the state level of politics and you want to bring in a lot of outside money, some of these big national donors become very, very vital to your future. Mm-hmm. And so they've had a lot of influence with these governors. They've tried to spin them up. But, boy, when you start to play that game of being deferent to big money, of treating politics more seriously than anything else, including governing, you start to create a record, and that record comes back to haunt you. I think it is problematic for the Koch brothers.
Yeah. This is very, very interesting. You know, the billionaire era of politics and what it has brought us. John Nichols, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, thenation.com. John, as always, thank you for dropping by today.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Thank you for your brilliant insights and your great reporting. We will be back right after the break, 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I got to tell you something about polar vortexes that's going to blow your mind. 5 minutes from now. And welcome back, 16 minutes past the hour. And Willie in Riverdale, Georgia. Hey, Willie, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Yes, sir. Thank you for accepting my call. Mm-hmm. Basically, I just want your professional opinion pertaining to the unemployment insurance. Do you feel that legislation will, in fact, pass this bill in the near future? And if not, why?
I think that the Republicans, the only reason that an extension of long-term unemployment benefits has not passed, it was routinely passed throughout the Bush years. The only reason it hasn't passed is, and it got a majority in the House of Representatives, and it got a majority in the United States Senate, but the Republicans filibustered it in the Senate. And I'm not sure which Republican put forward the filibuster, but basically they were all, you know, in on it. And so the question is, can they get 60 votes in the Senate? You know, will a couple of Republicans give in? And increasingly we're hearing that Olympia Snowe in particular seems to be leading this charge. Or is it Susan Collins? Susan Collins. Olympia Snowe resigned. The senator from Maine, one of the senators from Maine, has been leading, Republican senators, has been leading this charge to put this thing forward, that the Republicans are, that people, I mean, you got 1.6 million, 1.7 million, 1.8 million, it grows by, you know, 60, 70, 80,000 people a week who are losing their unemployment benefits, and they are figuring out that the only thing standing between them and an unemployment check, after they, in many cases, worked 20, 30, 40 years paying into the unemployment insurance trust fund, the only thing standing between them and that check is a Republican filibuster in the Senate. And so I would be, frankly, very surprised if that political pressure does not reach something of a boiling point for the Republicans in the Senate. And Mitch McConnell's been being beat up pretty badly about this by Allison Lundgren Grimes in his home state of Kentucky, even though Rand Paul is totally opposed to any unemployment benefits beyond 26 weeks, and in theory, all unemployment benefits. So I'm thinking that it's going to pass, and probably in the next week or two. But Willie, I'm often wrong, so I don't know. Do you not have any inside information? I'm guessing.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you for your opinion.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot, Willie. Good to hear from you, Mac in Gig Harbor, Washington, listening on KBCS. Just a minute to the break, Mac. You got a quick one?
It's not quick, Tom, but here it is. I've been a lifelong Democrat, but I'm no longer a Democrat because of how they've handled it in Washington State regarding medical cannabis.
Really?
They've passed a bill that completely guts and strips the medical cannabis system that's taken 13 years to evolve in one of the most progressive states.
Well, my understanding is what they're doing is they're shifting people who are buying from medical dispensaries over to these state-licensed, state-taxed dispensaries that are also available for recreational use, so that they can tax them and regulate them.
That's it. But then they've also got a firmly established system that works well for people, and they're changing the amount that people that have the ability to grow at home can grow for their medicine. Some people use concentrated oil to fight cancer, and it takes a pound of dried bud to make a 3-month supply of oil.
Whoa.
And 3-month supply is not necessarily enough, and there are people that can't grow their own that need that oil. So there are collectives that work to supply this medicine to people, and they're going to screw that completely up, so people will have to pay way more money that they can't afford.
Yeah. Mac, do you know who your state representative and state senators are?
You know, calling these people makes no difference. The Democrats.
Okay. Mac, I'm sorry, we're out of time. Polar vortex. Yes, indeed. Okay, here I am in Washington, D.C., the place where the polar vortex has been particularly shocking. I mean, you know, if you lived in Vermont, cold winters. I lived in Vermont for 10 years. I lived in New Hampshire for 5 years. I grew up in Michigan. cold winters are nothing shocking in any of those places. But in Washington, D.C., you know, this is the beginning of the, this is basically the Mason-Dixon line. It's the beginning of the South. And south of here, it's pretty shocking stuff. So two things that I wanted to share with you. One comes out of the other. The first is this from Jeff Masters over at the Weather Underground. And it's in the Atlantic and reprinted over at Democratic Underground by Brooklynite. Temperatures 20 degrees below normal will likely invade the upper Midwest on Sunday. That's 3 days hence. And gradually spread southeastwards during the week. That's next week. The peak cold is predicted to occur late next week with temperatures 20 to 35 below normal covering the eastern two-thirds of the country. As a result of these new model runs, the natural gas market has been soaring ever since early this morning and is now approaching a five-year high of $6. So, in fact, it topped out Wednesday afternoon with prices at $6.25. That was yesterday afternoon. So the polar vortex is coming back. Now, that's okay. Your basic weather report. Now we go to the Arctic News blog. It's arctic-news.blogspot.com. And this is one of the most fascinating science-driven blogs. In fact, Peter Wadhams is their lead contributor. He's one of the most famous climate scientists in the world. And I just want to share with you a couple of paragraphs that Dr. Malcolm Light wrote that was published over on that blog, that Arctic News blog, a couple of days ago. It should still be up on the part that's visible. He talks about the Gulf Stream. You know the Gulf Stream that carries warm water from the Pacific down around the southern tip of South Africa, up along the east coast of the United States, picks up a lot of heat along the way, and then goes out to sea over the North Atlantic and a couple hundred miles off the coast of Greenland and England. It basically settles to the bottom of the ocean at that point. It has lost enough salinity and enough heat that it settles to the bottom, and then there's a reverse current. This is a 1,000-year-long cycle that this current makes. And the heat that it loses in the North Atlantic is what warms up Europe. It's why Europe, which is at a latitude not dissimilar to Alaska, has, instead of Alaskan weather, has, you know, weather like the Middle West of the United States, or the Central United States, which is at a much further south latitude. So he writes that the volume of water transported by the Gulf Stream off the East Coast has increased by three times since the 1940s because of massive increase in wind drag. Now, you say, well, what's this got to do with anything, with the polar vortex? The increase in the southwesterly wind drag is a result of the continuously increasing pressure difference set up between the continental air mass over North America, heated by fossil fuel-generated carbon dioxide, and the marine air over the Atlantic. The increased energy entering the Gulf Stream as heat and its associated winds and storms are what are now pummeling Great Britain and Europe. They're having record storms in England right now, 100-mile-an-hour winds, places that they've never had them before. This heat is transported further north by branches of the Gulf Stream into the Arctic Ocean itself, where it's destabilizing the subsea methane hydrates. Now, those of you who've been to lasthours.org and watched the movie that we put up there, there's a little 10-minute video that I helped to write and I narrate, know that when the subsea methane hydrates get destabilized, it's time to duck and cover. I mean, it's serious. This is serious stuff. He continues, destabilizing the subsea methane hydrates, releasing increasing volumes of methane into the Arctic atmosphere and causing temperature anomalies this last winter of more than 20 degrees Celsius. Yes, at our latitudes, it is 1 degree warmer than it was 50 years ago. In the Arctic, it's 20 degrees warmer. Not supposed to happen. He continues, Dr. Malcolm Light, as a consequence of the extremely high Arctic temperatures and pressures, the normal freezing Arctic air has been displaced into Canada and the United States, causing catastrophic blizzards that have never been seen before. When the floating Arctic ice cap melts toward the end of next year, The Arctic Ocean will then become more aggressively heated by the sun and the northern offshoots of the Gulf Stream. In other words, this whole thing that's causing this is going to get worse. Under these circumstances, he writes, the cold Arctic air will be confined over the Greenland ice cap, and the Arctic atmosphere will rotate anticlockwise around Greenland, transferring the fast increasing amounts of its atmospheric methane to Canada and the United States and causing a further increase in the energy of the Gulf Stream. So here we're now to the consequence of all of this is going back to feed the source of all this. That's called a positive feedback loop. His last sentence, therefore, the United Kingdom and Europe must brace themselves for even more catastrophic weather systems, widespread flooding, and massive wind damage from the start of the last quarter of next year. In other words, next fall. Now, by next year, I'm not sure exactly when he wrote this. I think this was fairly recently, so presumably by next year. Yeah, he's talking about not 2015. But when you look at the methane concentrations just from February to February 2013 to 2014, it is absolutely startling to see all this methane being released. And you've got these scientists saying, we need to come up with a plan. And not just a plan to slow down the rate at which we're releasing carbon dioxide. A plan to stop it, a plan to reverse it. And beyond that, you know, is it time to start having a conversation about how to survive it? We have these seed storage places, maybe human storage places. I don't know. It's pretty, pretty bizarre. In the midst of all this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Well, there is that. But in the midst of this, also, we have the fossil fuel industry pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into denying the science. The bad and the very, very famitoriously ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good, Sally Jewell. On Wednesday, the Secretary of the Interior announced the approval of two major new solar energy projects. The first, the State Line Solar Project, will be located along the Nevada-California border. It will produce enough energy to power 90,000 homes. The second, the Silver State Solar Project, will also be located on the Nevada-California border and will produce enough energy to power 80,000 homes. Both projects are part of the Obama administration's Climate Action Plan, which the president first announced in a speech last June. Solar is the future. Good on the Secretary of Interior for helping us get closer to having a totally renewable energy infrastructure. The bad. Lady Teresa Thoms. According to a new report put out by the advocacy group TFN Insider, the candidate for Texas State Board of Education is not such a big fan of education. In fact, in a conservative voter's guide obtained by TFN, Thom said that she, quote, strongly disagrees that it is the government's responsibility to be sure children are properly educated, end of quote. In other words, Thom doesn't believe in the position she's running for. You know what they say. Only in Texas. And the very, very ugly McDonald's. An Olean, New York branch of the fast food chain is under fire today over allegations that it fired an employee for buying a group of firefighters lunch. Employee Heather Levia had already bought lunch for a group of firefighters earlier on in the day when another fire department called and asked for a big $70 order. Levia says that her decision to pay for that second department's order is what got her in trouble with management.
So Heather texted her boss to see if the company would pick up the tab for the firefighters. She thought they might because she says they routinely give free meals to police officers who come in.
It's very common in our store.
Her boss said no, they don't donate food. Heather called the corporate office and got the same answer. So she and fellow workers again picked up the tab. And when word spread that Heather paid the bill, some firefighters called her boss and complained, thinking the restaurant made Heather feel obligated to pay for their meals.
She said, you opened a whole bee's nest.
At her next shift, after 8 years of working for McDonald's, Heather was fired.
McDonald's has fired Heather Lavia because she, quote, swore at a superior, but she denies those allegations. If her story is true and McDonald's did fire her for buying lunch for firefighters, well, that's just very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Janie in Round Rock, Texas. Hey, Janie, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you, Tom.
Hi, Janie.
My call is about, like, you and Mike were talking regarding our being able or not being able to sue and hold prosecutably accountable our politicians for violating representation of us, their oaths of office, et cetera.
Right. So the principal vehicle we have to hold them accountable is the election.
Right, right. But, you know, I think that they've gone way past just replacing them in some regards. I think that some things are not negotiable as politics and should never be considered negotiable or weapons that politicians could use. I think it has to do with what we've allowed our definition of politics to become. And there's just some things that are not negotiable. Anything that causes human suffering is off the table. You don't get to play with that. It's not a weapon. And I think that we just need to work really hard to redefine what we will allow to be negotiable and what we will absolutely take off the table.
You want to put some meat on those bones? Give me some specifics. What are you thinking of when you talk in these abstractions?
Anything that has to do with causing human suffering, things like cutting people off of unemployment, deliberately refusing to make jobs, health insurance, health coverage, food stamps, survival things.
Right.
Anything that's going to cause somebody severe mental, psychological, damage. These things are just barbaric. They're way, way in the past. They're unintelligent. They're beneath all of us. And they're shameful. But the thing is, the Republicans today are just so darn proud of it.
Well, here's the Rush Limbaugh pitch on this. Or I shouldn't say Rush Limbaugh. Here's maybe the Rand Paul or the libertarian / Republican pitch. When government, first of all, it requires you to assume that government is not us, that the United States of America is somehow some kind of alien entity that has been foisted upon us by evil people. But when government gives money or food or medical care to people, those people become dependent on that government, and they will continue to elect the politicians who gave them the money or the food or the health care. Now, I agree with that. I wouldn't use the word dependent, but I agree with that. I think that's how politics is supposed to work. I think that if we like Social Security and a politician supports it, that we vote for that person and, things work out well. But Republicans see that as a form of dependency. And so if you weren't born rich or you didn't inherit a railroad like the hero and heroine in Atlas Shrugged, then tough luck. So,
yeah, well, but the point is about the Republicans and who they've made themselves to be is that they don't want you to have that opportunity, really. I mean, the tax money is our money. The government is our government. It's us, and they are to represent us in our best interest. But they're just finding ways to take the money that we have paid that belongs to us and take it and put it in their pockets.
Yeah. Well, this is
just the services we need.
Yeah. What you're seeing is the invisible hand. It's not the invisible hand of the marketplace, though. It's the invisible hand of billionaires buying politicians and buying public policy and buying public opinion, actually. So thank you for the call, Janie. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Stephen in New York City, listening on WBAI. Hey, Stephen.
I'm not listening on BAI.
Okay.
I wanted to follow up about your discussion with about the Ukraine.
With Stephen Cohen yesterday.
Huh?
With Stephen Cohen yesterday, third hour?
I wasn't supposed to mention the name because he's not there to defend himself.
Okay.
So I won't particularly characterize what I think was his one-sided take on who's behind what has turned now into an armed rebellion. I would suggest that your listeners take a look at a YouTube video called Ukraine Rising, which was shot by an independent videographer back in mid to late December when this uprising was just beginning. And that will give a very good idea of at least the kind of folk who were involved at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
One doesn't see the kind of dark, sinister, rightist forces in those videos. I do want to say
I don't think that Professor Cohen was suggesting that that's what's driving this. He was arguing that the people around the fringes who are committing the acts of violence are not all of them are these hardcore rightists, but a significant number of them are.
Well, but he was suggesting that there's this sort of menacing rightist component
to the violence.
Well,
yes.
I also heard him. Apparently, he is on some kind of little crusade about this because some 2+ weeks ago, he was also on that other progressive media outlet, Democracy Now!, where he was much more clearly making this statement. And
Well, he has the cover story in the Nation magazine.
Raising the specter of the anti-Semitism of these rightist elements.
That's right.
So that, to me, is his take. He was quite patronizing to the other guest on that program, who happened to be a Ukrainian who had just recently visited the Ukraine. I do want to say this about Mr. Putin. The professor quoted in his interview with Amy Goodman 2 weeks ago with respect to a certain lunatic Ukrainian cleric who was making anti-Semitic statements. This is what Reuters reports today as a summary of Mr. Putin's suggestion to the government of Ukraine, that there must be an immediate end to the bloodshed. But how does he suggest that this be accomplished? He says there is a need to take urgent measures to stabilize the situation and suppress extremist and terrorist attacks.
Sure.
Now, I suggest that people also go to YouTube today and see very recent video that they can search for by putting in Kiev, February 20. And you will see in the first 3 or 4 videos that come up that are quite recent of the bloodshed, which went on, I guess, you know, earlier today,
mm-hmm.
Where Reuters reports some 50 people were killed,
right.
Where you will see the security force, the riot police, who I believe are called the Berkat.
They're using live ammunition. Stephen, there's not good guys. I don't think that there's any clear good guys and bad guys in this thing. It's an absolute mess. Thank you for your call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The big problem is that you have Western Ukraine who speaks Ukrainian and wants to join the EU. You have Eastern Ukraine that speaks Russian and wants to stay with Russia. Welcome back. And Paul, watching Free Speech TV in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul, what's up? Paul, you're on the air.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
All right. Well, if we continue on our same course, there was a movie in the 70s that would probably depict what's going to happen to us. They built these domes and everybody had to live in them. It was called Logan's Run.
I don't remember having seen that movie. I'm not sure I did.
Well, you had to have little life crystals, and you died when you were 30 years old, and
yeah, I missed the movie. I'm sorry.
Thing and stuff like that. But basically, everybody on the since we poisoned the planet so bad, everybody had to live in these big giant domes.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the only way you could control the atmosphere.
Right.
And that'd be the perfect way to control society.
Yeah.
Living in a dome.
Yeah. So do you think the global climate change is going to provoke us to the point where to as a survival mechanism to have to build giant geodesic domes and hunker down.
I think if we do not change our ways within 2 decades, completely get off fossil fuels, our children's children will be doing this.
I don't disagree. I think if we don't do something within the next 2 decades, and something quite radical, something quite dramatic, our children's children may not even be. And if they are, they will be confronting horrors that we can barely imagine. So, yeah, I think we've got some really, really serious problems that we're facing. Paul, thanks for the call. I'm with you. Tom in Kalkaska, Michigan. Hey, Tom. You want to talk about the banksters?
Yeah. I've been thinking about, we have such a large population in this country. What do you think would happen if about half of them, or a little more than half, moved their money out of the banksters in New York?
I think that the big step. I mean, obviously, if average Americans, if citizens were to move money out of banks and into credit unions, that's a good thing. But the real big step would be for states to do it. You know, if California was to pull all its money out of the New York banks and either put it in California-based credit unions, California-based community banks, or even better, a bank owned by the state of California, where all the profits that bank generates go back into the state treasury, California would suddenly find itself in an incredible surplus position. And it's not just true of California. I just use them as an example because their economy is the sixth largest in the world if it were an independent nation, maybe seventh largest. And they represent, about 18-20%, some mind-boggling percentage of the total economy of the United States. So this is something North Dakota has been doing since 1918, as I recall, since the 19-teens anyway. And it's something that every state should do. Ellen Brown has written eloquently about this over at her website, webofdebt.com.
I would think that would help the economy a whole lot if that would happen.
It would, and it would stabilize our banking system. If every state was to create a state-chartered bank the way that North Dakota has, then it would diminish the power and basically the monopoly influence, both in Washington, D.C., and economically nationwide, that the six largest banks in New York City have. And that would be a good thing. It would be a good thing for us. It would be a good thing for democracy. It would be a good thing for the people. And, instead of Jamie Dimon making an extra $10 million, California would be able to feed their hungry people, provide health care to people who can't get it right now. What a novel idea. So, the Talk Ready News Service, let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Ready News Service and find out what's going on in the world. Brought to you, of course, by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria, what's happening in the world?
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Well, the situation in Kiev in Ukraine is evolving, getting more serious by the hour. The European Union has imposed targeted sanctions on Ukraine. The White House is urgently considering sanctions. It wouldn't surprise me if we hear about them within the next 24 hours. And Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany spoke with both President Putin of Russia and President Obama today. She briefed them about the trip of the three European foreign ministers in Kiev. All three leaders agreed that a political solution needs to be found as soon as possible to prevent further bloodshed. And President Obama today urged President Yanukovych of Ukraine in a statement to withdraw his forces from downtown Kiev immediately. He also said Ukraine should respect the right of protest and that protesters must be peaceful. Now, the Kremlin issued a statement with Putin blaming radical protesters and voicing extreme concern about the escalation of armed confrontation in Ukraine. It's very difficult to get exact numbers of the number dead and injured, but it seems from both sides there's at least 70 protesters and possibly police have been killed today, and that about 570 people have been injured.
This looks like the early days of a civil war to me.
That word was used yesterday by one of the British newspapers the words nobody wants to hear.
Right.
It could be devolving to that.
Right. Victoria, you suggested that there needs to be a political solution. Has anybody proposed an outline for that political solution? I know back 5-6 months ago, when the European Union and the United States said to the president of Ukraine, we will give you 800,000 800 million euros, roughly 1.2 billion U.S. dollars in aid, if you will join with us, but you also have to accept over 20 or over 30 different laws and rules, including defense treaties, basically becoming a junior partner to NATO, which would be sort of like the Soviet Union putting missiles in Cuba right now. And then Putin came along, President Putin, and said, I'll give you $15 billion in aid right now, and you don't have to make any commitment at all, because I would like to work out a thing where Europe can cooperate with you and I can cooperate with you, and we can have a tripartite system. And then the EU and the United States said, no, we will not participate in a tripartite system. It's all or nothing. You've got to pick one or the other. And he ended up picking Putin. That's the kind of the backstory to what happened here. What kind of political solution is possible as long as the U.S. and the EU say that they will not collaborate with or cooperate with Russia in supporting the Ukraine?
Well, nothing, as far as I know, has been put forward publicly. I don't know what happened. These foreign ministers apparently met with Yanukovych for 5 hours today. So I don't know whether anything was put forward, whether they even got that far, whether it was that kind of conversation, or whether it was a conversation about de-escalation.
Is the conflict confined to Kiev, or is it happening all along that north-south line that basically cleaves the Russian-speaking east from the Ukrainian-speaking west?
It seems at this point to be pretty much confined to Kiev. That, at least, is all that we are hearing about. If there are protests elsewhere, they are not being reported on.
Okay. So what else is going on in the world?
Other things that are going on in the world are that the president will not include chained CPI in his budget coming out on March the 4th. Now, he did include chained CPI, a proposed cut to Social Security benefits, in his budget last year.
Right. And Senator Sanders had a meeting with him, which he talked about on this program, Senator Sanders and a few other senators, and said basically, if you do this chained CPI thing, you're going to kill the Democratic Party, and it's going to be a terrible mess, and you will not have our support anymore. And it looks, and of course they were reacting to their constituents who have been saying the same thing. So it looks like the parade caught up with the president.
It does. More than 100 House Democrats wrote to the president yesterday, and that was following a similar letter from 16 Senate Democrats that was led by Senator Bernie Sanders. Yes.
Right. Great.
So he's not going to do it, and of course the Republicans are saying, president has no interest in doing anything even modest to address our looming debt crisis.
Well, Social Security has nothing to do with the debt crisis. It's a special line item. It's got a $2.7 trillion surplus right now.
They do tend to get conflated.
Yeah, at least in the minds of Republicans.
The White House plans to propose stiffer tax rules for U.S. companies with overseas operations. It wants to limit what it's doing as tax avoidance and evasion through profit shifting and other means, senior administration officials said today. Now, this is also going to be in the budget.
Now, can they do this by executive order?
Well, no. It would have to be approved by Democrats and Republicans in Congress to become law. So
wait a minute. The president is hoping that the Republicans in Congress will try to force corporations to pay their fair share of taxes?
Yes. Now, well, some of this could be quite popular with voters. It's going to do things like tighten rules for digital transactions that some companies design to limit the taxes they pay on some income. And it would address a move by some companies that load up on debt in their U.S. operation, generating large deductions, and then use that capital to fund investments overseas.
Right. So, in other words, it would bring home jobs.
Yeah, probably.
Quite possibly.
Sounds good. I still don't believe the Republicans will, you know, they're going to declare this budget dead on arrival.
I mean, the president's going to propose a lot of things in his budget.
Yeah, yeah.
Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts plans to introduce a bill that would require new handguns to be outfitted with personalization technology within 2 years. And basically, you can't shoot the gun if it's not yours.
That's brilliant. That, you know, they've been doing that with tasers since they first came on the market. I don't know why we can't do it with guns. The cost is $8 a gun. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. Pleased to have you with us. And Lori Wallach is on the line with us. She's the executive director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, citizen.org/trade. Is their website. Lori, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. The president just did a really pretty stunning turnaround on Social Security, announcing that he's not going to propose cuts to Social Security in his new budget. Is there any possibility that there might be a turnaround coming with regard to the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, also known as that would be SHAFTA, also known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
There is no sign of that, unfortunately.
Oh. Okay, so what's the latest with the TPP and Fast Track?
There are large teams of negotiators right now in Singapore, U.S., and from the other 11 countries trying to finish the agreement. And this Saturday, the top U.S. trade negotiator, the cabinet member, U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Michael Froman, heads to meet with his counterparts from all the other countries to hopefully announce a deal. Now, there are enough problems that keep a possibility of a real deal being done, a lot of which are other countries saying no to the crazy corporate proposals the U.S. is pushing, that if they announce a deal, it's going to be kind of like a kabuki dance deal, where it's like a big ritual to try and create momentum to push Congress on fast track and to set up the president's trip to Asia. They really can't make a final deal, but they're getting dang close.
So let me see if I understand this. Congress, there's strong congressional opposition to this, both from Tea Party Republicans, conservative Republicans, and progressive Democrats, and in fact, increasingly mainstream Democrats. But they still have the corporate Democrats and the institutional Republican Party with them on doing this, because this is, after all, what the multinational corporations want. And if they can convince enough members of Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, to pass the what is this called? The buy. Go ahead.
Fast track. It's fast track.
But there was a name for the bill. It was called the Bipartisan Trade Promotion Authority or something like that.
Right, but you know, that's sort of similar to calling really bad breath the different breath disorder
That's sort of a sanitary way of of naming it. It's fast track.
Yeah,
it's Nixon's old legislative luge run to run bad trade agreements right through Congress.
Right, but if they can, and if they can establish a sense of inevitability in the international press and among the electorate that, hey, this thing's going to happen, then Congress may say, well, okay, it's going to happen. So I don't want to be the odd man out voting against it. Is that their strategy?
Well, what they basically want to do is use it's a chicken and egg issue. They want to create the sense of momentum about TPP to get Congress to delegate its trade authority, and they want to use a fake sense that Congress will ever delegate its trade authority to get momentum to get the countries to give away the shirt and sign TPP.
Right.
And so it's whichever caves first, basically. It's like a whole game of optics. But in fact, even with the corporate Democrats right now, there are not a whole lot of them who are willing to say they support this old-style fast-track bill. So the other countries are looking kind of warily at the U.S. saying, maybe the emperor has no clothes. I've got this trade negotiator and this trade ambassador all saying, yes, don't worry. It's easy. We'll get fast-track. It's just a little delayed. Don't worry. We'll put Congress in handcuffs. Whatever we tell you, it's we can deliver it, really, wink, wink. And then you've got a lot of countries saying, if I, like, give away the stuff they're asking me to, people's access to affordable medicine, the ability to regulate securities firms and banks, the ability to have local development in my country, I'm in trouble. But if I do all of that and then I actually don't even get my pieces of silver, I don't even get the things that U.S. said they trade in exchange, which is what they're afraid will happen if Congress isn't handcuffed with fast track, well, then I'm really in trouble. So it's a circular thing where the other countries basically know what the U.S. is pushing so outrageous that they're not sure that they can make that last deal unless they really think Congress is basically bound and gagged.
And isn't the entire or the major fulcrum point for this, the thing that this hinges on, the ability to pass fast track, because without fast track, they're actually going to end up with a bill that can be debated and can be amended.
Yes.
And so,
I mean, it's not just that. In addition, under fast track, the executive branch is empowered to write legislation, which obviously is not something they normally are allowed to do.
It's not even in the Constitution.
Yeah. And it's not just that, but they can write legislation that doesn't even go to the committees for amendment and markup. So what that means is not just that they control the total content of the agreement and they have this guaranteed vote with no amendments and limited debate, but also it means they can ram all kinds of goodies and trade-offs and favorite little tricks to buy votes into the legislation that is not subject to amendment in committee or on the floor. So the way Fast Track makes sure really bad trade agreements get passed is a combination of taking away all the normal procedural safeguards that could be used to air out or stop a bad bill, and then having this special procedural super glue to stick in goodies unrelated to trade to buy the remaining votes that you haven't been able to arm twist.
So
it's really dangerous.
So people need to contact their member of the House of Representatives and their two senators and say no to fast track, and that may put the kibosh on TPP. Do I have that right?
The number one contribution an American activist, an American citizen, resident, anyone hearing this can do to make sure there isn't the Trans-Pacific Partnership is to make sure there isn't fast track. And so everyone should have the phone number I'm about to give on their fridge at all times, right in a yellow sticky, put it on your fridge with a magnet, here it comes. It's the Capitol switchboard, 202-225-3121, 202-225-3121. Here's the thing. It's really easy to call your member of Congress because you're going to get an operator, and you don't even have to know exactly who your member of the House of Representatives is. You just give your zip code, and they will connect you to the right office. And then you simply say, I'm a constituent. I want in writing to my house in the district mailed the member of Congress's commitment to oppose fast track. I do not want my congressman to give up his or her legislative authority, constitutional authority, and my delegated authority as a voter to stop another bad trade agreement. And I know TPP is coming down the road, NAFTA on steroids, so I want you to let me know the member of Congress is going to vote no on fast track. And we basically just have to hound these guys until we get everyone pinned down that they're going to. And right now, there are enough of them saying they're not willing to that the thing is stuck.
Right.
But the other side's really gearing up.
And people can also find that phone number at callcongress.org, which points to a page on our website and presumably at citizen.org, right?
Yep.
And so that phone number is available. It's fairly easy to call. So call and just say no to this. Lori, we're going to hit a hard break here in about 15 seconds. So I can't, that's step one. Step two, is there a next thing that people should be doing?
They should be getting the word out. So
right.
The polling, and there's a recent poll shows when folks know about this, they oppose Democrats, Republicans, independents. So if you go to the website, expose the TPP.org. That's www.expose the TPP.org. You will find all the materials you need on every issue of impact. So if you have friends interested in food, you got that. Jobs issues, environment, you name it, it's there. Get the word out.
ExposeTheTPP.org. Lori Wallach from Public Citizen. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
ExposeTheTPP.org. Check it out. Share it with everybody you know. We will be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rick watching Free Speech TV in Irwin, Tennessee on Dish Network. Thank you, Rick, for watching Free Speech. What's up?
You know what I wanted to talk about? That girl was talking about non-negotiables.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the main non-negotiable should be like, you know, some place to live and something to eat, you know?
Yeah.
I'm a baby boomer from the counterculture. You know, I'm going to turn 62 here pretty soon, so I'm going to have to draw Social Security because nobody's giving me a job. But when these idiots start cutting off food stamps and all that stuff, people are going to have to try to make money somehow. And if the only way they can do it is illegally, you might as well rob a damn bank. You know, as steal out of a damn paper machine.
Yeah. Well, in Crash of 2016, I opened one of the chapters of the story of a fellow who walked into a bank and robbed it for $1 because he was sick and he needed medical treatment, and the only way he could get it was to go to jail. And he went to jail and he got the medical treatment.
You know what? I'm sitting here and I got one of my eyes is going bad. My wife has TN care. We're in Tennessee, so she has TN care, mm-hmm. and she had to have cataract surgery. And the doctor said that when you know you have a cataract is when it looks like you're looking through a dirty windshield.
Right.
And my right eye has been doing that for, like, over the past, 8, 10, 12 months, and it's getting worse and worse, and it's starting to affect the other eye. And I told my wife, I said, we got to move some. If this idiot here is not going to take the TN care money, we got to move somewhere where I can get it. I grew up in California, so I could probably, you know, go there and, you know, get signed up pronto because, you know, I'm an ex-felon and I did all my time out there. And back, I was born in 52, so the 70s, 80s, I was an adult fiend and a criminal. And then I came to Tennessee in 91, and since then I've been, you know, on the pretty straight and narrow. But, I mean, I'm 62 years old, brother. Nobody is going to hire a 62-year-old ex-convict to do any kind of a job.
Yeah, it's a sad thing. Basically, increasingly, nobody's hiring 62-year-old anythings to do anything.
Right. I'm going to go apply for Social Security tomorrow.
Yeah.
I turned 62 on March 23rd.
Wow.
I made my appointment for tomorrow, and I'm also going to sign up for SSI,
mm-hmm.
right? I figure, you know, like my age and my criminal record, I mean, it probably won't, but it should qualify me for SSI because the way I look at it is like my work history is going to give me about $328 a month, right?
Mm-hmm.
And plus, I'm going to get $189 in food stamps. and I got to try to survive on that. So I'm just going to tell these idiots, look, you know what? You can either, like, give me SSI or, you know, like, when I get caught, you can pay $50,000 a year.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a sad, that's a horrible choice. And that's a sad commentary on the state of our society. Rick, thank you for the call. I wish you the best, my friend. I wish you the very best. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. 20 minutes past the hour, we'll be right back. Welcome back. I saw the most amazing thing on YouTube this morning, and rather than telling you the story of it, I asked Sean if she could track down the guy who did it, and he's with us, Jason Roberts. He's the host of Simple Misfits. Their YouTube channel is youtube.com/SimpleMisfits, and it's a really amazing piece. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us what you did, what you saw, what provoked you, and what you accomplished.
So what actually sparked this initial idea was I actually locked my keys in my car, and I had to call AAA. And it happens to everybody once in a while. And when AAA arrived, he was trying to break into my car to get my keys, and he just happened to be an African-American guy. And what I started to notice as I looked around is that people started eyeing him in a negative
way. So the locksmith was black, and people were looking at him like, what's this guy doing?
He was obviously a professional. He had the AAA jacket on.
Right.
He was a professional, but somebody actually came up to me at one point and asked, like, is he with you?
Right.
Which really shocked me. So I figured I would reenact this whole process and see if I would get the same result. And I was shocked at the difference of the reactions that I got when I went out and did it versus when my friend Clinton went out and did it.
And I saw the video. Your friend, you're white, your friend Clinton is black, and on the video, this is an amazing video, you were breaking into your car with a coat hanger on a public street as people were walking by for, what, 30 minutes?
Yeah, a little over half an hour.
Yeah, with the car alarm going off, wah, 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 wah. And all these people, nobody gave you a second look.
No one said anything to me. No one tried to stop me. Cops were there at one point. They didn't say a word.
A police car literally drove by and stopped for a light next to you as you were breaking into your car and then continued going when the light changed.
Didn't even notice me.
Yeah. So then what happened when your friend who was African-American broke into your car?
So we set up the camera. This family passed by. This Hispanic family passed by. I noticed that they stopped. They started staring they started looking at Quentin and what he was doing. And then they noticed, oh, wait, he's trying to break into the car. 2 minutes later, the cops show up. I couldn't catch the footage of the family calling. I saw them with their phone out, but they kept going in and out of the store,
mm-hmm.
trying to double check on what's going on. And sure enough, 2 minutes later, the cops were there with, I think it was 5 squad cars.
So you, the white guy, break into your own car for 30 minutes. Nobody says anything. Your friend, African-American guy, breaks into your car. Within 2 minutes, there's 5 police. And they didn't just, like, come by. They put him up against the wall.
Yeah, they also put me up against the wall as well. They took it to a whole nother level. I didn't think that it was necessary, one, to have 5 patrol cars, 10 cops there, and I believe there's a helicopter. I heard a helicopter above me,
mm-hmm.
but I wasn't sure if it was for me or not.
Right.
But yeah, I didn't think that it would have to be taken to the level of being handcuffed and background checked, even though I proved to the cops that that was in fact my car, and
and this was your friend, and you asked him to open the door for you.
Exactly.
And at that point, what were they thinking of charging you with something? I mean,
no. Afterwards, they let us go with no charges,
Were they nice to you at that point, or I mean, did we?
I mean, they weren't happy about the prank. They weren't necessarily nice, but
right. They
understood that. At the end of the day, it wasn't a serious matter. It was just a prank.
Right. Were any of the cops black?
Press charges. Not that I recall.
Yeah.
I remember Asian and white.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the carry home message that you actually, I think I see one police officer might be African American. I'm looking at the clip right now. Oh, that's the guy handcuffed. Oh, that's your friend who's handcuffed. Yeah. Okay. I'm looking at a freeze frame here. So what's the carry home for you, Jason? What's the lesson that you learned from this and that you're trying to share with people by putting this up on YouTube? You could see it over at youtube.com/simplemisfits.
I would just say, you know, keep an eye out. I mean, I didn't make this video intending it to get this big. It was just more of a social experiment for my own fun.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just
well, in the wake of
stereotypes are still very much alive, even though we don't think that it is. We don't believe that it's. We believe like everyone is treated equally. But I mean, I just.
I think your timing on this thing, I mean, this is just a couple of days after a white guy gets off for murdering a black kid, you know, and it's
yeah.
and basically his defense was he was black and so I was afraid of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yeah, I heard about that.
And so here what we have is in your case, you know, white guys can break into cars, black guys can't, and even when they own the car, and mm-hmm. You know. So this is really a commentary on the fact that racism or even I'm not even sure you call it racism, racial awareness, fear of race, whatever, fear of other is alive and well in America. Was this a largely white neighborhood or was it a mixed neighborhood or was it that you were doing this? Most of the people walking by seem to me to be white.
This was in Hollywood.
In Hollywood. Okay.
In basically central L.A.
Yeah, in central L.A. So there's a large black population, but Hollywood is mostly a white community. So your friend probably...
I think it's pretty multicultural, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing story. Jason Roberts, he's the host of Simple Misfits. Their YouTube channel is youtube.com/simplemisfits. If you haven't seen this video, it's really, really worth checking out. Jason, thanks for the great idea that you followed through on and did so well. And thanks for being on our program today.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good talking to you. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Tom Hartman program, 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mentioned the polar vortex is coming back earlier in the hour. I want to touch on that one more time, and we're going to pick up your calls as well. Hey, it's Thursday. Let's get geeky. Geeky science, the 1-3 minute period every week where Louise and Sean let me get into my favorite thing, science here. If the food doesn't get you, the packaging might. At least that's one of the takeaways from a new report released by some of the world's top scientists. This was published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. And what science did is they were talking about the use of cancer-causing substances like formaldehyde. Yes, formaldehyde does cause cancer. And it's in the packaging of foods, drinks, and dinnerware products. According to this report, there are over 4,000 different chemicals used in food and food product packaging that we can potentially come into contact with. Formaldehyde, in particular, is known to as a human carcinogen, cancer causer. And can increase the risk for various cancers, including sinus cancer and leukemia. And according to the scientists, the formaldehyde could potentially attach to food or be absorbed by drinks and wreak havoc with the human body. The report says food contact materials are a significant source of chemical food contamination, although legally they are not considered contaminants. As a result, humans consuming packaged or processed foods are chronically exposed to synthetic chemicals at low levels throughout most of their lives, including the most sensitive periods of development. That would be when they're young. Scientists also believe that there may be links between the chemicals in food packaging and a whole variety of other products or other issues, health issues, like obesity, diabetes, and neurological development. These are pretty startling findings, and a lot more research needs to be done to find out what's actually going on with this. But formaldehyde in our food packaging? Really? To make matters worse, formaldehyde is legal to use in food packaging and is already found in some foods. So it might be time to start avoiding these processed foods altogether, because not only is the food unhealthy, but it looks like the packaging is too. I always wondered, you know, you get one of these microwave meals that I, you know, occasionally we'll get them at the health food store. And made by health food companies. Gluten-free, vegan, stick in the microwave. And you stick it in the microwave, and it's like, wait a minute, this is in a paper tray. It's got some sort of a, it's got to have some kind of chemical in there to keep the paper from absorbing the water. It's got plastic over the top of it. Can this really be good for you? Time to go back to getting, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables and making your own meals. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, thanks for listening on TuneIn Radio. What's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Oh, well, I'm just enjoying your show, but I got a couple things.
Say it again, Charles. You're.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was my phone. No, yeah. I said I'm just enjoying your show today, but I do have a couple things that was on my mind.
Okay.
Okay. First, with Mike Capitonio,
mm-hmm.
He did make a statement earlier that he thinks the Attorney General is scared to prosecute some people.
Yeah, specifically and, the banksters.
Okay, but I also gotta feel like I should stick up for him as well. You know. You have to realize the climate that we're in, especially with the Tea Party climate. And what I see is, to be honest with you, looking around at the situation with Chris Christie, you have a governor that's in battle as well in North Carolina. I forgot what his name is.
McCrory.
You have McCrory.
Or McCrony.
Okay. Then you get. I'm sorry?
I call him McCrony, but McCrory.
Oh, McCrony, okay. Right, you have Scott Walker.
Yeah.
You know, he's had Silver AIDS indicted, and I think also went to jail. I think Republicans, they have actually taken advantage of the system, and some of them are abusing it.
But see, I think if this attorney general, if Mr. Holder and the, his president, President Obama, were to do what Reagan and his AG did, which, you know, Reagan prosecuted, I think eventually something like 600 people went to jail. It was over 1,000 were seriously investigated and prosecuted in the savings and loan crash. I think the Tea Party would be actually enthusiastic about that. I think that prosecuting banksters is something that both Republicans and Democrats would applaud. It's just that the bankster billionaires wouldn't applaud it, and they're funding, frankly, both parties.
Okay, well, my point is this, though. As far as, like I said, the climate, you have a you had the former governor of Virginia. He got indicted, and he's also claiming that it's the Obama administration that's attacking him.
Sure.
And of course, Eric Holder. And what I'm trying to say is they're building up a climate of discontent, you know, or whatever, or as far as I'm concerned, it's really racist in some ways. But it's just part of their game plan as far as turning people against this administration. As far as Ronald Reagan is concerned, I seem to remember that George Bush's son, Neil Bush, was involved in that.
He was. He made off with the Silverado savings and loan, and he made off with a big pile of money, and Neil Bush was never prosecuted because his dad was the vice president. I mean, you know, come on, let's... You know, and I don't think that was about race. That was about power. In connection.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they only use the power when it benefits them. That's another point.
Yeah.
As far as I feel sorry for the people in Ukraine.
But hang on just a second, Charles. Isn't it possible to acknowledge that regardless of somebody's race, that because the Supreme Court has set up this political system where they say that money is protected by the First Amendment, that a politician can be influenced, if not corrupted, by the power of organized money, that the banksters have been able to basically intimidate not just the Republicans, but and actually I think that they've bought the Republicans. I think the Republicans love them. But I think that they're intimidating the Democrats, including this president. Is that not possible? Can't we acknowledge that?
I would think that I would say that's something that's always been done.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying Obama's unique in this regard. I think, you know, Bill Clinton did what the banksters wanted too. In my opinion, to get this cancer out of our body politic, we have to amend the Constitution of the United States to say that the Supreme Court was wrong when they said that money is protected by the First Amendment. The money is property. It's not speech. And the Supreme Court was wrong when they said that corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment. Corporations are legal fictions, not persons. And we just need to amend the Constitution to say that unambiguously, and then we can have clean politics.
And when are we going to also clean up as far as the money is concerned? Money, I don't think all of this money has to be in politics, because basically we're picking leaders that's funded by all of these rich guys.
Yeah, but see, that money's going to stay in politics as long as the Supreme Court says that you can't stop it because it's protected by the First Amendment.
But we have to have some reform when it comes to
Yeah, I mean, that was the essence of Citizens United. That was the essence of the Citizens United decision, which struck down the McCain-Feingold limits on campaign finances.
Okay, well, I got one more point that I wanted to make.
Go for it, Charles.
As far as Vladimir Putin is concerned,
mm-hmm.
those people in Ukraine, to me, I consider them very lucky right now. Because if it wasn't for the Olympics, with Putin's power, with his influence, it would be a bloodbath. We already see his influence in Syria, where we actually eased up on Syria, and Syria is still back at it again.
He helped us out in Syria, Charles. I mean, it's not my job to defend Vladimir Putin, first of all. Let me make that very clear. And it was Putin who got Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, to surrender his chemical weapons. And they're being destroyed right now, out in the Gulf and on a U.S. aircraft carrier.
Right, but I thought we had a promise with them as far as that concerned.
This is not to say Assad has suddenly become a good guy, but I mean, mm-hmm. We supported Saddam Hussein for 30 years. You know, Donald Rumsfeld, the lizard person, used to go over and shake his hand and sell him, weapons of mass destruction. My thing with Russia is not, gee, they're wonderful. My thing with Russia is, why can't we collaborate with them? Let's make the world a better place by collaborating rather than having conflict. We don't need another Cold War. I lived through one in my life, and it was not a good thing. We don't need more nuclear weapons. We don't need more, that's not a road that we need to be going down. And I see us going down that road right now, and it concerns me.
Well, I'm worried about him because he's such a hardliner, And one more thing, the Republicans always saying that, people want to, put their money, get everything from the government. Well, as far as unemployment insurance, I thought that was a contract, either a moral contract or something in writing that, once we put our money, once they took the money out of our checks, for FDIC and everything else, and unemployment insurance, that, we at least have some type of guarantee that if we weren't working, we could still be able to take care of our families with that little bit of insurance.
Charles,
and I would think that this government depends on us more.
I'm with you. In fact, let me just make the point here, and feel free to tell me it's none of my business, but how many years out of your life have you worked in the workplace?
I have been out of work for the past couple of years, but I'm 44, and I've been working since the age of 15.
So you've worked.
I started off at McDonald's.
You've worked close to 30 years. Every single one of those years, you paid into the unemployment insurance fund, and so I'm with you. You paid in. That's a moral contract. It's at the very least, and you paid it in. And if you are unemployed right now, you should be getting unemployment insurance. And the only thing that's stopping it is the Republicans in the United States Senate filibustering it. It even got a majority vote in the United States Senate, but they said, no, it's got to be 60 votes, not 50 out of 100. You got to have 60 out of 100. And so they're blocking it using a procedural method. So, this is on the Republicans, and we need to be holding them accountable. Charles, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I think whether somebody's worked 5 years in their life or 1 year in their life or, you know, in my case, over 40 years, you're entitled to unemployment insurance if you can't find a job. Welcome back. Rashid, listening to WBAI in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Rashid, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you.
I'm driving in to teach a class right now, and I was listening. I always listen to your program as I go to my evening class, and I was listening to from Tennessee talking about the difficulty of just surviving, you know, when you're having these kinds of economic struggles, and you know, a lot of us are familiar with that.
Yep.
But what made me want to call you is that I just showed my class last week and the first part of this week a film called The House I Live In.
The what? Say it again.
The House I Live In.
Oh, The House I Live In. Okay, thank you. Your phone dropped there for a second. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, so the film is about America's drug war, which is actually the course that we're going through right now.
Right.
And you can't help but think about the what's coming to be referred to as the prison industrial complex.
Yep.
And when you look at the extreme poverty that you see that you're seeing in the country, it drives people into crime. It drives people into illegitimate opportunity structures because they can't find opportunity in the approved structures.
Right, and people are by nature wired to be entrepreneurs, and if there are no legitimate entrepreneurial opportunities available to you, you will take an illegitimate entrepreneurial opportunity. If you can't sell, you know, hardware and by starting a hardware store, or if you can't sell muffins by starting a muffin store, you will sell drugs because that's the only thing that's around to sell.
Exactly so, and for a lot of people, particularly in poor communities, not only black communities, but poor communities in general,
sure,
and black communities in specific, drugs are it's a company town.
Oh, yeah. When I lived in Oregon, store. There are small towns in Oregon. Roseburg was one of them that are white towns that are just ravaged by meth. You know, it's like it's a major industry because there's no jobs. It's just there's nothing left.
Absolutely. So the thing is that because human beings are complex, adaptive systems, we're always going to find some way to survive because that's the prime imperative for us is to survive. And if that's what it is, that's what it is. But you can't help but think about the way that poor people are being driven into the prisons.
Yes.
And then, you know, there's a whole superstructure that depends upon the imprisonment. And it's growing. It's not like this thing is being, you know, controlled or reduced.
And it's,
you know,
profitable. It's profitable,
absolutely
Rashid.
Profitable. The privatization is very frightening
because
it drives the need to have people. There were a couple of judges not too long ago that just got arrested and convicted in Pennsylvania. And the one's doing time down in Florida, the other one in the Midwest somewhere, I think, who were arrested because they were steering kids to prison for kickback money, because to the tune of a couple of million.
And these were private for-profit prisons. I'm with you. I think one of the greatest sins against democracy is privatizing the commons. And frankly, the worst of all those sins, and I'm totally, you know, with privatizing prisons is a crime. The biggest crime is privatizing our vote. They've done that now. So we have private for-profit corporations counting our votes and telling us how we voted in, and they're doing it in secret. And that, you know, so there, which opens a whole another conversation. But I'm absolutely with you. It's time to end the drug war and time to ban privatization of prisons. Thank you, Rashid. Very interesting. The Supreme Court is going to pick up a case about the EPA and regulating carbon. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Dwayne in Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, what's on your mind?
Yeah, first of all, I wanted to thank you very much for your coverage of the Ukraine, keeping us up to date, and the fast-track issues. And that leads to where I wanted to be, is I fear that the fast-track agreements may affect the state banks and credit unions, our efforts to straighten out our banking system. And if we went to a state bank that the fast track, they may file claims in the secret tribunals against our use of a state bank as opposed to opening it wide open to international bankers.
That's what I fear. Do you know if that's, we've had some things leaked by WikiLeaks, but basically I don't think we really know outside of the one of the food things. Do you have any evidence? Do you have any reason to believe that TPP, also known as SHAFTA, would ban the states from starting their own banks like North Dakota has done?
Well, so much of the time, the same committees, these same tribunals have ruled rather water systems in South America and postal system and one place, I believe.
You're right.
I think it is the woman you had on, Laurie.
Laurie Wallach, yeah, with Citizen.org.
They have a site, I think, that lists all of the lawsuits and the decisions that have been reached, and that may be on there.
Right. It would be Citizen.org/trade. It's almost certainly there. Dwayne, we need to be, and Laurie, last time she was on, she said the battle is first going to be held in the House of Representatives. And, so contact your member of the House, but also your senators, and you can go to callcongress.org to get the phone number for Congress. And in fact, just a minute ago, I had it up. I don't have it in front of me right now, but it's easily tracked down. And call your members of your member of the House of Representatives and your two senators and say no to fast track and no to TPP. Dwayne, thanks for the call. Peter in Rockland, California. Hey, Peter, you wanted to talk about Ukraine?
Yes, sir. Hi, Tom. Great speaking to you. I listened to the interview you had with Dr. Cohen last night, and although I'm a huge fan of his, I was concerned about the characterization of the Ukrainian people. I know that in a very short amount of time, it's very hard to escape the broad stroke of any opinion, but I, for one, have a book on Amazon.com called Children of the Holocaust. My mother was 15 years old when Hitler went across the border and picked up the eldest from every family and promised that they'd have the children back within 6 months. Well, my parents went to Germany separately on labor trains, and my father eventually spent time in a concentration camp and was basically saved by the Black Panther Division. So there are a lot of folks who are patriots here. My father and mother went on to work in the defense industry here, and three of us served in the military. We are patriots, and we appreciate the fact that...
You're of Ukrainian ancestry? Is that the beginning point of all this?
Excuse me?
Is the beginning point of this story that this all happened in the Ukraine, that your parents are from Ukraine?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And what I see today is their quest for their own country. That land is extremely valuable. It is the agricultural half, and the other half being the energy sector, which is under the influence of Putin and the oligarchs that are on the east side. And if you look at the wealthiest individuals in Ukraine, you'll find a tremendous amount of billionaires in that region. So we're up against a force that is larger than our opinion of the Ukraine, and that's what we have to. I just want to make sure that we're not painting all Ukrainians as fascists.
It's very easy to hear a word and have it pop out and exaggerate its importance in our own minds. My understanding of what Dr. Cohen was saying was not that right-wingers or fascists were driving this conflict in the Ukraine, but that rather, much like when Occupy, for example, would rise up in Oakland, California, and you would have out of 10,000 people who showed up, peaceful people who showed up for an Occupy movement, you'd have 15 or 20 black bloc people who would go smash windows. And then the media characterized the entire Occupy movement as being those 15 or 20 anarchists who were smashing the windows. And, similarly, my understanding of what Dr. Cohen was saying, Professor Cohen was saying, was that there is a small number of hardcore right-wingers who are quasi-nationalists but also kind of quasi-fascists who are engaging in violence, who are shooting at the police, who are throwing Molotov cocktails, and they are very problematic for the nationalists and the people who just, you know, are kind of like, leave our country alone. Both sides, you know, maybe we don't want to be the EU with the EU. Maybe we don't want to be with Russia. Maybe we just like to have trade agreements with both or something like that. But, you know, Ukraine for Ukraine. But those folks are being their positions are being overshadowed by this violence. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And I concur with you completely. I just wanted to bring to light that we're very concerned. We need America's support as Ukrainians, and regardless of what our position is there, there is a Ukraine here that is expatriate. We have a diaspora that is huge here, and we're very supportive of this government, and we would hope that that the U.S. would be supportive of our need to be independent of Russia.
Yeah. And perhaps independent of the EU as well, if that's the choice of Ukraine.
That might be the case. It might serve them best, but certainly they have a relationship that is very, very difficult to separate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you've got that divide down that north-south divide that cuts the country east-west that makes it even more problematic. Peter, thank you for the call. A very thoughtful analysis. Thank you. Tomorrow, it's Friday, so Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here for the first hour of our program, taking your calls, plus anything goes Friday. Your turn to choose the topic, what's on your mind, all the news and information you won't hear on corporate-owned news media right here on Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag your it. Get out there and occupy
You've
something.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.